You're listening to Amphibicast.
This episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by Grey Ghost Creations. Specializing in unique wildlife art for lovers of reptiles, amphibians, and arachnids, Grey Ghost Creations offers a wide variety of art prints, stickers, pins, necklaces, and more. To find more unique original art, be sure to visit Grey Ghost Creations on Etsy at www.greyghostcreations.etsy.com. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining me again. You're listening to Amphibicast. I'm your host, Andrew Bates, and this week I have an amazing guest. I have Dr. Carl Loeffler-Henry, and we're going to talk about how bright coloration and toxicity evolved hand in hand, and the paradox of why an individual species would opt for this type of coloration at its own risk. And Carl has been able to solve that paradox, and there's a lot of interesting stuff that we're going to cover, and we're going to get all into it. He just released some of his work, and we're going to discuss it. But before that, of course, I want to thank everybody for the nice 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Always appreciate that. And if you're looking to support the show, there's a couple of great ways to do so. First way is to become a patron on Patreon. I have tiers as low as $1 a month, and I have the more popular $5 a month tier, which will get you a shout out at the beginning of an upcoming episode. And I also have a link tree in the show notes. That'll take you to the merch store if you want to get some cool stuff, swag. I've got t-shirts, stickers, and all that fun stuff. And you'll also find a link to In Situ Ecosystems. If you make a purchase through the link in the link tree, you'll get a 10% discount just for being a listener. So, other than that, I think we're ready to go. Carl, welcome. How you doing? Thank you for coming to talk to us. What's going on?
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. Now, I mean, in my intro, I kind of touched on very, very briefly what we're going to discuss. And I want to get into it really is a complex topic that you took on with your research. But I was wondering, before we get into that, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself. What were some of your earliest experiences with amphibians or the natural world, or what led you to where you are today?
Yeah, well, so I've been really fascinated and passionate about biodiversity for as long as I can remember. I think it's kind of an innate interest. Pretty much from the time I could walk, I was just always wanting to go to pet stores, wanting to see and experience biodiversity, see different species, and learn about animals. As I got older, I was always, you know, I was that guy always reading books about animals, watching documentaries, just accumulating as much knowledge as I could, just completely passionate about this. And really, a lot of my first exposure to different species was just through pet stores, you know, starting in the 90s and the early 2000s. Just I would always go straight for the fish, reptile and amphibian areas, and, you know, just see whatever I could, always looking for something new and something interesting with respect to biodiversity. So that's pretty much been my life up until now. And that naturally sort of lended itself to a career as an evolutionary biologist. So when I was in high school and even earlier in grade school, I was just so passionate about biodiversity that I really had very little interest in what they were actually teaching in school. So often my grades were quite poor, and I always knew I wanted to be a biologist, but my grades being as poor as they were, that may have been a potential barrier. So when I was 15, I actually approached a professor at university and asked if I could just take one course as a sample. This is naturally before I completed high school. And so I did very well in that particular course, and that professor allowed me, professor who is Michael Runce here at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada, he allowed me to take all of his courses. And so I did quite well in those courses, and I was able to start my bachelor's degree on the basis of those courses rather than a high school diploma. And so from there, I got my bachelor's degree and then went on to pursue a PhD in evolutionary biology, specifically focused on the evolution of animal coloration. And I recently completed that. And so the work we're going to be talking about today was sort of partially done during my PhD. And then also I completed it as a postdoc a few years after that.
That's quite a story. And I do agree with you about grades having the potential to be a barrier, especially when you want to get into science. And that's great that you were able to really make it happen in a pretty unique way. I give you a lot of credit for that.
Thank you.
Yeah. If it makes you feel any better, my grades weren't great in school either, but, yes, when I was young, I had the same aspirations. Like, I want to go make wildlife documentaries. I want to study wildlife and whatnot. And then I realized that a big portion of science was math. And that was about the end of that for me because my math skills were subpar. But, was there any specific animal that was like a key, like pivotal moment that gave you inspiration as terms of like why you wanted to focus on coloration?
Well, I wouldn't say it was a specific animal. So my sort of heroes, if you will, in evolutionary biology are the really pivotal researchers from the latter half of the 19th century. So Darwin, Wallace, moving into the 20th century, Ronald Fisher, etc. So these, a lot of the insights, the fundamental insights about the nature of life on Earth that they were able to glean were based on animal coloration just because it's such an observable phenomena. And so the thing is, after they made these you know, key insights, with the arising of all of these other different disciplines of biology, you know, genetics and bioinformatics and acoustic ecology, just to name a few, I wouldn't say that the study of animal coloration was forgotten, but I think that there's still a lot of opportunity and a lot of scientists look at, you know, these different subdisciplines, leaving plenty of opportunity for new discoveries in these areas. So that really inspired me to sort of go down the route of studying animal coloration.
And obviously, I mean, the focus of my show usually is dendrobatids, and dendrobatids mm-hmm. are by and large pretty colorful, but coloration is convergent. It exists in all different species and all different clades. I mean, I was wondering if you could tell us about the different types of coloration that are found in animals, not necessarily specific to amphibians, but mm-hmm. what are some different types of coloration or adaptations, however you want to phrase it. And what are some of their advantages and disadvantages?
Yeah. So there's really quite a few potential different, animal coloration conditions, but, the two main ones that we typically think about when discussing anti-predation defense are camouflage. So colors and patterns that match the background environment, like you see in, for instance, the Vietnamese mossy frog. And then the axiomatic solution to that is aposematism, wherein you have bright, conspicuous colors that presumably serve to signal to potential predators that you have some form of noxious defense that they may, you know, not want to try and eat you for that reason.
And are there any, I mean, we're going to dive into this more. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of the best way to approach it because it is kind of a complex topic. I mean, I guess my own way I'm trying to wrap my head around this, but in a general sense, why is one not advantageous to the other? Meaning, why do we have both adaptations exist and not just a single one?
Well, so in evolution, it's all about trade-offs in ecological context. So if you think of an ecosystem as sort of an ever-changing mosaic of different selective pressures from, you know, abiotic factors like temperature and access to water, or biotic factors like predation or competition with other animals, depending on the specific circumstances that a species finds itself in, one solution may have benefits that the other doesn't, and vice versa. So that's why we see this diversity of different coloration strategies in different species, because each species is subject to a different set of selective pressures.
I see. And do you notice a greater variety in like high biodiversity areas? Because to me, it seems like when I think of areas that have very high biodiversity, especially Central and South America, like, you know, Colombia, for example, or Brazil, I see so many animals that are cryptic colored and so many that are aposematic. In your opinion, does that like vary depending on biodiversity? Like, are you more likely to see all different color adaptations where there's more species as opposed to a more limited type of environment?
Well, I think that having a greater number of species in a given environment sort of lends itself to greater diversity in terms of anti-predation strategies, just because there's more species. So I'm not aware of any research that quantifies latitudinal patterns in anti-predation coloration and latitude. However, you do see both strategies in both temperate and tropical environments. So you and I are both in northeastern North America, and just as an example, we have leopard frogs and bullfrogs, which are camouflaged. We also have aposematic species like ambystomid salamanders and eastern newts, so spotted salamanders and red Fs. So you see both strategies represented in a variety of different environments, and I'm not 100% sure if the frequency varies between different environments in a meaningful way.
I see. It's just one of those things I'm always curious about.
Yeah, well, that would be a great study. If there's anyone listening who would like to perform that study, you know, please do. I'd love to have the answer. So to make a long story short, I think that it's an open research question.
Interesting. Very interesting. So, let me quote this. Okay. So, this is how I found you. I found an article in New Scientist. Okay. And, I'm going to pull up the article right now, through the magic of technology. All right. There was a few different things. I've got one here, evolutionary transitions from camouflage to aposematism, hidden signals play a pivotal role. But I've also got this article that I found in, New Scientist. And it mentions a paradox in regards to color adaptation. And it's something that I've always wondered. And it seems like if an animal is going to evolve to be brightly colored, it's kind of like it's self-sacrificing. It almost doesn't seem like a very efficient strategy. Like, I could understand an animal hiding because it just seems like by default you would hide. But like, why make yourself more visible? Why become this visual presence and then have to be eaten before another animal realizes that you're toxic? So I'm gonna quote you, and I'm gonna let you kind of take it from here, because your research really explains it. So in New Scientist, you stated that you have this paradoxical catch-22 where in order for predators to know that bright coloration is associated with the chemical defense, they have to sample an individual. But sampling that individual kills that individual, so it prevents the spread of that adaptation. So I was curious if you could just kind of walk us through the paradox, what the stages of elevation are, and which species you studied and what your findings were. I know it's a lot, but this just fascinated me. So, the floor is yours, my friend. Go for it.
Yeah. So, I'll start with which species we studied and why. So we looked at amphibians as a group, and amphibians really lend themselves to researching evolutionary patterns in animal coloration for a couple of reasons. First of all, we know the phylogenetic relationships of almost all living amphibians. So they've sequenced enough of the genomes of almost every species of amphibian, or at least one representative from every genus of amphibian, very often more than that, such that we know how amphibians are interrelated. Another benefit to studying amphibians is that in addition to predation forming a selective pressure influencing the evolution of animal coloration, sexual selection also plays a role. So in some groups, the peacock is an obvious example of this. They have conspicuous coloration, but it's not because they're signaling to predators that they might be toxic. They have this coloration to attract females. In amphibians, in most cases, sexual selection hasn't influenced the evolution of anti-predation coloration, I should say. It's anti-predation defense that has shaped this. So we can get rid of a lot of the noise that would make it difficult to observe how predation is influencing selection that we might experience with other groups. Another benefit of amphibians is that they're very, very diverse. There's an enormous number of species, and within different lineages, aposematism and camouflage have evolved independently many, many times. So that gives us a lot of statistical power to examine the evolutionary trajectory of how you get from one coloration state to another. So in terms of how aposematism evolves, so in addition to camouflage and aposematism, a lot of species utilize a sort of composite strategy wherein they will have a camouflaged coloration on the dorsal surface, but then on the ventral surface, they will exhibit conspicuous coloration. It can also be on other surfaces that are usually hidden, like you see this. So Hyla versicolor, the gray tree frog, which is common throughout much of Eastern North America, has these bright yellow inner thighs that are only exposed when they move. So that sort of composite strategy, up until now, it wasn't really clear how that fit into the matrix of camouflage and aposematism. It's possible that that strategy offers sort of a best of both worlds and is sort of like potentially an evolutionary endpoint wherein you can get the benefits of aposematism when you're detected by a predator by exposing these signals. But if you're not detected, you can remain cryptic and avoid detection from predators and prey. Alternatively, what's possible is that these hidden signals serve as an intermediary to bridge the gap between camouflage and aposematism, which, as you mentioned, appears to be quite challenging. Because if predators don't know to associate the conspicuous coloration with a defense, then they have to sample you, and in so doing, they kill you, which makes it challenging to understand how the adaptation could spread in the population. So we examined the evolutionary trajectory of these different coloration states. Basically, what we did is, because we know the relatedness of each species to one another, and we categorized the coloration into really five categories, but for the purpose of this explanation, three: hidden signals, conspicuous coloration, aposematism, and crypsis. So we could reverse engineer the evolutionary trajectory of amphibian antepredation coloration. And what we found is that these hidden signals serve as an intermediary that facilitates the evolution of aposematism, such that it appears that basically you can get rid of the detectability costs of aposematism while being able to still signal upon detection. So that ability to signal upon detection while being cryptic appears to facilitate predator education long enough that the conspicuous coloration can then spread to the entire body, and you get full aposematism.
And in terms of a timeline, I mean, I don't know if you can necessarily nail it down to one exact number, but let's just say the evolution of we'll just take frogs. We'll just say anurans. Is there a point where you can say definitively that, you know, full aposematic coloration evolved and became an adaptation? Like, where the I'm trying to maintain all the terms that you're using, but in my limited vocabulary, species that are kind of half and half, you know, half aposematic, half camouflage, like you mentioned, like, I guess, like Bombina would be a good example, firebird toad.
Yeah, Bombina orientalis.
Did they start out and then slowly evolve, or was that something that's happened, you know, millions of years ago, hundreds of millions of years ago, tens of millions of years ago? Like, at what point would you see something that was really brightly aposematic and toxic, say, like one of the dart frogs that we see now?
Well, it's so in this study, we actually didn't do the time calibration of the phylogeny to see when aposematism evolved. But because aposematism has evolved independently so many times, there probably really isn't a cut and dry answer of how long it takes or how long it has taken. In different lineages, it likely happened at different points in geological time. But once again, that's an open research question that would be certainly fascinating to explore.
Interesting. On an unrelated topic, I had done a different episode a while back, and we were talking, the guest and I were talking about the evolution of teeth in frogs and how it's not really a thing. But It had evolved at different points throughout evolutionary history completely independently. They evolved, mm-hmm. they developed teeth, and they lost them. I mean, just from your perspective as someone who studies evolutionary biology, is it more common to have things evolve independently and then die out as opposed to something evolve in a completely linear fashion?
Well, it's really context dependent. So you have some traits that are very, very conserved across lineages. So one example of this would be the Unkin behavior that the Bombina genus displays. So they, when confronted by a predator, they sort of arch their back and expose the venter. So they have this sort of standardized anti-predation behavior. You see that behavior in many different lineages of frogs from different continents, and it appears that they have that that behavior as a result of homology, meaning that it evolved once and then was retained across many different lineages. Other traits like, well, chemical defense or conspicuous coloration, large body size in Orthoptera and Lepidoptera, various other traits seem to evolve independently many different times. So it really depends on selective pressures. And there's also a genetic component. So some traits are controlled by very conserved regions of the genomes of animals, whereas others are in parts of the genome that appear to be more liable. So there's lots of influences. And it, like lots of things in evolutionary biology, it's very much context dependent. So sorry to not give a linear answer, but...
No, that's perfect. One of the things that I'd always been curious about when it comes to evolution and evolutionary biology mm-hmm. is when we're young or when we're in school, I don't know if they still do this, but we always had this illustration of the image of the evolution of man, and it was this kind of prototypical like lobed finned fish that came up on land, turned into a salamander, which turned into a small mammal, which turned into a you know, a monkey, and then turned into a primitive human, et cetera. And it all seemed to be so linear, and it just seemed like, is that how everything evolved? You know, it's like all these oversimplifications. I learned throughout the course of doing this show from, you know, talking to people like you, that there's so many start and stop situations in evolution that it's really, really hard to just pinpoint just, you know, a beginning and an end to an evolutionary process. Like from what you're telling me, there seems to be this whole big mosaic effect going on where there's more things going on than we can really count at one moment.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Humans seem to have this tendency to really like linear stories. So a good example of this is the evolution of horses. So for a long time, it was believed that horse evolution was sort of this linear path towards large body size and reduced number of toes. However, what it actually appears to be is that the small number of horse species that are living today are large and have a reduced number of toes. And there were many species in the past that were smaller and had more toes. But when you look across geological time, you really don't have this kind of trend of horses going from small with a lot of toes to large with few toes. It's more that there's like you said, just a mosaic of different phenotypes. And then it just so happens that at this one particular snapshot in time where we're looking at the species that are alive now, they are large and have just one toe, but that's not reflective of the evolutionary path that the lineages took.
I see. And of all the species of amphibians that you studied for this study, were there any unique anomalies or anything like that that was noteworthy? Meaning like, I think Bombina is kind of like a primitive species as opposed to some of the more derived species, but were you able to, I guess, isolate any odd situations where something might have adapted in a way that you didn't expect, or something that might have been ahead of its time or behind its time? Like, did any situations like that come up?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing, some members of the Vietnamese mossy frog genus don't appear to fall directly into the categories of camouflage aposematism or the composite strategy in between camouflage and aposematism, but they actually mimic bird droppings like a lot of caterpillars. And so the reason for that may be to avoid predation, or it may be to attract flies, so so-called aggressive mimicry where they're attracting their prey or some combination therein. Another example that really stuck out to me is You see, so I mentioned the Unkin reflex before, where Bambina will curl up to expose the ventral surface, which has the conspicuous coloration. A lot of species that have achieved full aposematism still retain this behavior when they're confronted by a predator. They curl up and show the venter, even though the venter is the same color as the dorsum. And that's we think it's what is known as an evolutionary anachronism, which is the retention of a behavior that no longer provides a benefit, but there isn't sufficient selection to lose that behavior, so it's retained, and it sort of tells you something about the evolutionary history of particular lineages.
That's interesting. So it's almost like a vestigial behavior then.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
That's wild. Yeah, I it's interesting you bring up Theloderma, and you're right. There's the Vietnamese mossy frog is perfectly cryptic colored. I have a couple of them downstairs in my frog room, and I love them. They're beautiful. But it's interesting how, you're right, one evolves to look like its environment, and another evolves to look like something that's in its environment, but not like part of it. And mm-hmm. that was another thing that intrigued me was, well, why didn't everything in the genus evolve to look like something that was around, you know, its environment, as opposed to be developing this really, really specific adaptation to mimic, you know, bird droppings? It just seemed like such an odd thing. I mean, is that a genetic thing within the species that gives them some sort of, I guess, like a plasticity in terms of how they would evolve to match their surroundings?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, we really don't have all the answers of exactly how it happens, but probably this particular species, through a combination of having sufficient plasticity to express a coloration that sufficiently resembled bird droppings such that it could be mistaken for birds, and then birds would start selecting for closer and closer resemblance. So that's probably what happened in this particular lineage, if that answers your question.
Yeah, I guess the way I could put it would be, let's just say for argument's sake, we'll take the two genera. We'll take Theloderma, and mm-hmm. we'll take Dendrobates. You know, two familiar genera. One is cryptic, one is aposematic. Okay, so if we were to go in a straight line, I know we talked about linear, but I'm just trying to, I guess, make it simple. Is Theloderma more genetically predisposed to evolve in a way that is cryptic, and is Dendrobates evolved in a way that's more designed towards to go aposematic, meaning like in 5 million years from now, are we going to see a Dendrobated that looks like bird poop, and are we going to see something that comes from Theloderma that looks like a poison frog?
Yeah, that's it's really not possible to predict how they're going to evolve when they're cryptic or aposematic based on the phenotypes that we see now. So what we found in the study is that aposematic species tend to evolve towards crypsis through polymorphism. So you'll have an aposematic species that has both apos, or you'll have a species that has both aposematic and cryptic morphs within the same species. Whereas to get from camouflage to aposematism, it tends to be facilitated through these hidden signals. So Theloderma, we don't see any species that have hidden signals within the genus, so they would likely need to acquire hidden signals before they could make the jump to aposematism.
I see. And what are hidden signals? Can you elaborate on that more for the audience?
Yes, yeah. So hidden signals are sort of this composite strategy where you have a cryptic dorsum. So the parts of the body that are typically exposed are camouflaged. But then there are other parts of the body, like the underside or within the inner thighs, that have aposematic coloration that's only exposed transiently through behavioral displays.
I see. And do different species with varying levels of exposed bright coloration, like, is there a difference in terms of how they would fare against predators? Like, I guess what I mean to say is, Are some more successful than others because of the level of exposed bright coloration? And if so, why? I guess, I mean, again, to use Bombina as the default, like if Bombina is this kind of composite and say Phyllobates is, you know, bright yellow, is one more successful at avoiding predators than the others based on that adaptation?
So I wouldn't say that one is more successful, but it appears that depending on the degree of coverage, hidden signals can function in different ways. So in this particular study, what we did is we broke down hidden signals into two discrete categories. We had what we called FB, so hidden signals that fully cover the underside of the frog. So like Bombina would be a good example of that. And then we had what we call PV, which stands for part of the venter. FV stands for the full venter. And for the PV signals, what seemed... those are signals that cover just the inner thighs or a small portion of the ventral surface, so the underside. We think that the PV signals likely primarily function as what's known as a flash display. So when a frog is approached and initiates escape, so the frog will jump away, you will see the hidden signal in synchrony with movement, and then when the frog stops moving, they retract the hidden signal, whereas the FV, like the Bombina genus, they expose the ventral surface usually as part of a dematic display, so like I mentioned the Unkin reflex before, where they curl up and expose the venter, so they're stationary and they expose the signal in response to predation, threat of predation, in sort of a stationary manner. So that's sort of, they're used in different ways from a behavioral perspective, but to answer your question, I wouldn't say that one is likely to be more successful or less successful than the other.
I see. My reason for asking is we always hear about Phyllobates terribilis being the most toxic amphibian in the world, one of the most toxic animals on the planet. And if they're that toxic and they're that brightly colored, you'd think that they would be at least my thought process, they would dominate the planet because what would possibly eat them? Nothing, right? Yet they're not the most popular, they're not the most common species on the planet. They're actually relatively fragile, but I always wondered, how do they, why go through all the effort to evolve this if you're not going to become the dominant species? Like, why put so much effort into coloration and toxicity if you're going to have to get eaten by predators anyway, so that the predator can learn to avoid you? Like that was that paradox that really like drew me to your research. Like what sense do you make out of that, of a species that's highly toxic, highly colorful, yet still gets preyed upon? How does that bring this whole thing to full circle?
Yeah. So, to answer that question, I'll talk about work done by Kevin Arbuckle and Mike Speed, published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. What it appears to be the case is that having conspicuous coloration, promotes speciation. So one of the things that I'm sure you and your listeners will be well aware of is that dart frogs are incredibly diverse in terms of number of species, which is why the dart frog hobby is almost like its own enclave of herpetoculture in and of itself, because there's just so many species of dart frogs. The reason for that seems to be that if you think of a camouflaged frog, so you have a green frog, or let's say the mossy frog is a good example. The mossy frog, they look just like moss, which is great when you're on moss. The problem is that you can't exploit other habitats. You have to, without losing the benefit of camouflage, you have to be on the moss to for your anti-predation coloration to function. When you become aposematic, where you're signaling that you're defended and you're highly conspicuous, what happens is that you have the opportunity to utilize different habitat resources because you don't need to blend in against the background of any one particular habitat. So what was found in this particular paper is that aposematism lends itself to the evolution of more species. So once a lineage acquires conspicuous coloration, they tend to rapidly diversify into many more species than they would if they had stayed cryptic. But the flip side to that is that chemically defended amphibians appear to be more likely to go extinct than non-chemically defended amphibians. And we don't yet have a really conclusive answer as to why that happens. But one possibility is that if you're chemically defended, you likely face reduced predation pressure. And life history theory dictates that when predation is lower, you'll tend to produce fewer larger offspring rather than more small offspring. So we see this in amphibians, like Phyllobates is a good example. They produce very few tadpoles, whereas something like an American bullfrog produces, you know, hundreds to, you know, some species of frog produce thousands of tadpoles in one spawning event. So producing fewer young may predispose aposematic species to be more likely to go extinct. So we see higher rates of extinction in aposematic species and chemically defended species compared to camouflage species. So you have this kind of, once again, it's this sort of shifting mosaic where there are some benefits to one strategy and others to another, and you have this kind of dynamic equilibrium where both are maintained within the biosphere.
That's fascinating, actually. One of the things I always wondered was why do the poison frogs, why do they all produce relatively small clutches of eggs, especially like certain species like in the Ophaga genus, like Histrionica, Lamani, and whatnot, they're kind of difficult to get to reproduce anyway. And the Phyllobates, even if they produce a big spawn of, say, like 10 eggs, that's nothing compared to, you know, some of the, like American bullfrogs, a perfect example, where they produce, what, thousands, hundreds, if not thousands of eggs?
Yep.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never even thought about that being a function of coloration. That's pretty wild.
Yeah. Well, so it doesn't necessarily seem to be a function of coloration directly, but it's a function of reduced selective pressure. So it occurs, you see the same pattern in camouflage species that have chemical defense. So coloration definitely plays a role, but it's really the reduced selective pressure from predators that seems to drive that higher extinction rate.
I got it. Yeah, I'm visualizing it now. Like, I guess like if you're wearing camo to go hunting, all right, and you're wearing a certain type of camo that might blend in with, say, tundra, which is white, as opposed to something like deciduous forest. I mean, you know, you're going to stick out if you don't match the right place. But if you're wearing blaze orange, like you have to do during deer season, someone's going to see you no matter what you're in. So yeah, that's interesting. I never even thought of that as a method to be able to spread out into broader speciation. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Some work by Gopal Murali and Ulasa Kundaramaya, among others, extends that argument into lizards. And we see that lizards that have conspicuous coloration also seem to follow the same pattern.
And here's another question for you. And I know this is kind of like a loaded question, but does brighter coloration automatically equal higher toxicity? And I know that it's not true for every species, but what do you make of that? Like, are the most toxic species the most brightly colored, or how does that work out?
So that's a really good question, but there are real challenges in answering that, because different species. So when we categorize animals, we can roughly, just with human vision, get a pretty good idea of how conspicuous they are, or if they are conspicuous or camouflaged. But every single predator, every different species of predator has a different visual system, such that what appears to be extremely conspicuous to us might be less conspicuous to the predator. So it's really difficult to rank order the relative degree of conspicuousness. And it's also dependent on the background environment. A similar problem comes when we try and measure toxicity. So often they'll test the toxins on rodents. And I'll say, I don't support animal testing, but if this research has been done, I will report it. So they'll derive what's called an LD50. The problem with that is that, much like with the visual systems, different level, different toxins will affect different animals differently. So it's very difficult to rank order species in terms of how conspicuous they are and how toxic they are to their given predators. But we would expect that more chemically defended animals are going to be more conspicuous. But like I said, there are those challenges in doing that research.
You raise a good point, though, and I never really thought about it from that perspective. But yeah, we kind of, like the analogy I used earlier about the evolution of man, that kind of illustration, mm-hmm. You're right. You do raise a good point that a lot of the perception of toxicity is from a human or, you know, lab animal perspective. And it'd be interesting to see how other species would be affected by that, meaning like, I guess, like, is our defining Phyllobates terribilis as this, you know, the most toxic animal in the world? Is it relative just to what we've studied, or is it relative to, you know, other animals as well? I don't know. It's one of those things that always intrigued me, because you're right. We always think about what happens in lab rats and not necessarily what can happen in the thousands of other species that might encounter these animals in a wild setting.
Yeah, yeah. And one thing I'd like to add to that is that toxins are energetically expensive for animals to produce. So from their perspective, they want to be just toxic enough to prevent predation without producing something ridiculously, you know, much more toxic than they necessarily need. When you tend to see the evolution of extremely high levels of toxicity, appears to be when you sort of have an arms race situation going on between predator and prey. So the California newt is a really good example of this, where different populations of garter snakes have gotten progressively more and more resistant to their toxins. And so the newts then are selected to get more and more and more toxic to always try and be ahead of the garter snakes and avoid predation in that way. So the evolution of extreme toxicity is sort of a challenge in and of itself. To answer. And like I said before, every species seems to have a unique story of how they get to where they are.
Yeah, that's it's tetrodotoxin, right? In the California newts?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I had a guest on a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about that too. And that raised another question for me, because their toxicity is very, very intense. I guess you could potentially put it on par with the batrachotoxin. But they're not these little yellow, you know, golf balls that are hopping around that are just completely visible to everything around them. That's, again, that's just more of that paradox that just intrigued me so much.
Yeah, yeah. So this is purely skeptical, but even though they're so toxic to humans, they are relatively much less toxic to the predators that have co-evolved with them and have evolved this resistance. So it may be that they sort of are stuck in this state of not constantly exposing the conspicuous coloration because there are predators that are resistant to their toxicity. But that, you know, that's just purely conjecture.
No, that makes sense. I can almost see it like the arms race analogy that you used before. Yeah, it's right. They're not developing their toxin to kill us. They're developing their toxin mm-hmm. to kill the predator. And the fact that it kills us is completely incidental.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, in many cases, they may not want to actually kill the predator. So if you look at porcupines, their quills appear to be sublethal to predators like coyotes. And the rationale for why that would evolve, it's believed that actually keeping the predator alive is beneficial, because if the predator learns to avoid them and then teaches their young to also avoid them, it's more advantageous to the individual prey than just killing the predator outright.
Yeah, and that brings me into the next couple of questions. And obviously, we discussed the paradox. It's a catch-22. You evolve to look a certain way and have toxicity, but for it to work, a predator has to either kill you or be, you know, made sick, or so basically something has to happen for that animal to have a negative interaction with a predator for that predator to learn. So my first question about that is, Do you know of any percentage or like a finite number of amphibians in a given species or population that have to fall victim to predation before the adaptation actually becomes beneficial? Meaning like if you have a population of, say, I don't know, 10,000 frogs, we'll keep using phyllobates. Let's just say that you have a population of 10,000 phyllobates out there in Colombia. Like, how many of them fall prey to predators before that message gets across to predators to avoid them?
Yeah, well, once again, like many things in evolution, it's very much dependent on ecological context. So some predator species are going to learn faster than others. In some environments, there are going to be just more individual predators, which would mean that more have to be sampled to educate these predators. It's also probably partially dependent on how sick they make the predator. So if they make the predator very sick, then the predators may be better at remembering them. Another thing is that conspicuous coloration in and of itself seems to increase the rate at which predators learn. So something that's very conspicuous and very distinct from other species in the environment that are palatable, that the predators can eat perfectly fine. It seems that distinctness enhances predators' ability to learn to avoid a specific phenotype, a specific animal.
I see. So it's almost like, let's take the frogs out of the equation, for example. Let's just say that, a bird finds a brightly colored insect that also is, say, mildly toxic, and it tries to consume that insect. We'll say it's a beetle or something like that. It goes to eat the beetle, tastes bad, it gets sick, it spits it out. Now, say that beetle is bright red, will it be advantageous for the frog because now the bird has learned to avoid something that is bright red, even though it's a completely different species of animal? Like that adaptation, it kind of coexists with all the other species that have developed this type of coloration?
Yeah, so we do tend to see a convergence on common warning signals among chemically defended animals. This is what's known as Mullerian mimicry. So if you look at, for instance, bees and wasps, they're both defended and they have similar sort of black and yellow coloration. And by converging on that common warning signal, they can effectively share the burden of predator education so that each species has to be sampled less in order to educate predators. You see this. You see this in some dart frogs as well. Some of the thumbnail dart frogs, within a given location, different species will look similar, and that's for the same reason, to educate predators, to share the burden of predator education.
I see. Yeah, so it's almost like they're not evolving independent of everything going on around them. They're all kind of evolving to fit that mode, that if being brightly colored, and I really should be using your term, chemically defensive. If you're brightly colored and you've got a chemical defense, you're kind of in that arms race along with every other species, whether it's a beetle or whether it's a type of fruit or anything like that. That's all going to kind of be universally perceived as dangerous, right? That bright warning coloration. So, I mean, we've talked a little bit about mimicry, and we've talked about Mullerian mimicry and the trade-offs between, mimicking a species that has chemical defenses and whatnot. What are the other types of mimicry out there, and how do they play into this equation?
Yeah, so in addition to Mullerian mimicry, you also have Batesian mimicry. And what Batesian mimicry describes is when a non-chemically defended animal will mimic a chemically defended animal in order to sort of capitalize on the learned avoidance of predators of the chemically defended animal's warning signals, so their conspicuous coloration. So Mullerian mimicry we think of as mutualistic because both the mimic and the model, so both co-mimics, benefit from the resemblance to one another, whereas Batesian mimicry appears to be parasitic insofar as that the chemically defended animal is harmed by the non-chemically defended animal, because having a palatable animal that resembles the warning signal of a defended animal sort of degrades the credibility of that warning signal.
I see. And I'm going to throw you a curveball here. In terms of animals with chemical defenses, now there are some that have very, very significant chemical defenses. Again, Phyllobates terribilis is the kind of the benchmark that we've been running with here. What about species that have substantial toxicity that haven't evolved aposematic coloration, like say cane toads, for example? I mean, cane toads are lethal to many different species, yet they don't have any type of aposematic coloration. What are your thoughts on that? Like, how does that factor into the equation? Can you be successful from an evolutionary perspective as a chemically defensive toxic animal without any type of warning coloration?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that should be made clear is that in most of my research and in this particular study, we focus on visual signals, but there are also olfactory signals. So some of these chemically defended animals to other species will smell toxic, and in that way, they can inform predators not to attack them. But also, chemically defended animals can benefit simply because just by being chemically defended, even if they're not very likely to survive a sampling attempt, if even a small proportion of poisonous animals like cane toads, when they're attacked by predators, let's say, for instance, a fox bites a cane toad and immediately spits it out, even if a small fraction of those individuals survive, that can be enough to maintain selection for chemical defense. In our study, what we found is that chemical defense does occur in, obviously it does occur in non-conspicuously colored animals. However, they're much more likely to lose chemical defense than conspicuous animals. So in cryptic animals that have chemical defense, there's a high probability that across evolutionary time, they will lose that adaptation.
I see. And also, I mean, just to tie in what we talked earlier about you know, reproductive fecundity, I mean, to my knowledge, cane toads produce quite a bit of offspring, and they're not aposematic. They're, I guess you could call them cryptic colored. I mean, does that factor into that mold that we discussed earlier about like how, you know, the speciation and the brightly colored species kind of produce less, and that kind of go, I guess, independent of the toxicity, right? That's just a function of the coloration if it's a cryptic colored species?
Well, it's not entirely clear. And I should say that that's purely conjecture that chemically defended animals are likely to produce less offspring. So that's based on life history theory, which predicts that would happen, but as of yet we don't have that data. That said, there are going to be exceptions to every rule, and in particular when you look at cane toads, just because the females are so enormously large, they have the potential to produce large numbers of offspring, and it may be independent of their anti-predation adaptations.
Yeah, cane toads are kind of a monster no matter what you...
Yeah.
It's almost like they're from another planet, like aliens bioengineered this weapon of mass destruction and sent it to Earth.
Yeah, they're big enough to rival a small dog in terms of size. It's quite something.
Yeah, they're horrendous. That was one of the first species I kept back... Well, not the first species, but yeah, it was the first species of toad that I kept. I have... I actually have a wet specimen from 1996... that I had for a while, and it toad passed away, and I ended up preserving it, and it's still in pristine condition, which further goes to show you how out of this world they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this is, I guess, maybe a behavioral question or whatnot, but obviously a predator has to, I mean, the term used is to sample. Has to sample an animal that has chemical dependence and in some way has some sort of warning coloration. How do predators learn? Meaning, like, to go back and use the terribilis example again, say we had 10,000 terribilis over the course of, you know, say 100 acres, which is probably a pretty liberal sized population, but Say there was a predator in the area. I'm not too familiar with Colombia's mammals, but we'll just say a fox. Like, how many animals in the predator population have to sample these chemically defended animals before they learn to avoid them? Because obviously animals don't have, you know, the speech, they don't have culture, they don't have the same thing as that we do. I mean, primates arguably, but I mean, a fox is not going to be able to tell another fox, hey, avoid that frog because it made me sick. How does that dynamic play into this in terms of how these animals succeed based on coloration if they're still getting eaten anyway, and how many predators does it take before the predator learns not to eat them?
Well, so it depends. For something like a mammal, very often their parents will sort of educate them, usually their mother, about what is good to eat and what isn't. So in some cases, they may not need to sample any individuals at all, and this avoidance can sort of be retained within the population. For other species, they may need to sample several individuals before they actually figure out how that they're not an appropriate food source. It sort of depends on the learning ability of the animal, the severity of sampling a chemically defended animal, and how distinctive the aposematic animal is. So within that matrix, it will depend for each individual predatory taxa. Another mechanism, and this probably applies to Phyllobiades, just because they are so toxic, is that you can have the evolution of innate avoidance. So what will happen is that if every single bird or other predator that samples one of these dies, then those individuals within the population who just innately have no interest in or have some sort of aversion to sampling this particular species will be the only ones that pass on their genes to the next generation. And in that way, you can just have this kind of innate aversion within predator populations. And under those conditions, it may be that no individuals need to be sampled because it's just a genetically inherited trait to avoid these specific conspicuous animals that are also highly toxic.
I guess it kind of be like arachnophobia in people, where so many people are arachnophobic.
Exactly.
Yeah, like they avoid spiders just because, you know, somehow along the way, it's speculated that we've adapted to avoid certain animals because our genetic history has had, you know, bad interactions with them.
Some interesting work that's been done. They took straws with alternating red, black, and yellow bands that resemble coral snakes, and they found that captive-reared, completely naive birds innately avoided these straws, even with no prior experience of a coral snake, and the straws didn't even look all that much like a coral snake. But just that pattern of black, red, and yellow was enough that they would stay clear of anything that looked like that.
Really? It was that successful, huh?
Yeah, because coral snakes, as we know, they're extremely toxic. Many predators would really have no chance of survival if they were to try and sample one. So learning just isn't a plausible mechanism in many cases for how they would avoid such a conspicuously colored animal.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's amazing that they were able to figure that out based on pure instinct. I was wondering, I mean, there's many different warning colorations, but is there one that's like more associated with like aposematism than others? Like, and is there any that have more of a, like an effect on predators, meaning like yellow, orange, black, any of these colors? Like, is there like a certain color or a certain pattern that's more effective at deterring predation than others?
That doesn't seem to be the case. The one thing that seems to be consistent with aposematic signals is that they stand out against natural backgrounds like, you know, green leaves or bark or stones, etc. However, there seems to be a broad diversity in the colorations that you see. And I think the reason for that is that you want to stand out as much as possible against a given background. But because there are different backgrounds in different environments, selection is going to favor different colors. And then also some colorations are more conspicuous to some predators and less to others. So for instance, if you're signaling to a carnivorous mammal, most of which can't see red, then you'll probably have black and white or something like that. Whereas if you're signaling to birds that can see red, you're more likely to have red and just red or red in combination with other colors.
I see. So it's almost like, the analogy I used before about animals being toxic, not necessarily that they're not toxic to kill us. They're toxic to kill whatever it is that they're targeting, whatever predator. And I guess you could say the same thing with the coloration. It's like the fact that we can see red is incidental because they're not making it red. Well, they haven't evolved to become red for our eyes. They've become red to evolve for, like you just said, like a bird's eyes or color patterns for something else. It kind of reminds me of Orotas, Dendrobates orotas, which the type locale is kind of green and black, and it almost looks like a mottled kind of camo. Is there almost like a camo effect kind of going on simultaneously? Like for species that can't see these bright colors, does just the patterning in some way act as a deterrent or kind of like a secondhand camouflage?
Yeah, well, in some cases, you might not want to be as conspicuous as possible. So some of these colorations seem to function in a distance-dependent manner, wherein they're highly, highly conspicuous when you're close up. But if you step back, they have a way of sort of blending into the environment such that you only reveal how conspicuous you are when the predator is close enough that they probably already noticed you, but you can avoid detection from predators that are further away and so not even need to signal to them that you're chemically defended.
That's interesting. So would you say that this type of defense is effective, I guess, in, say, like short range, meaning to be a brightly colored red frog isn't like advantageous if a predator can see you from 20 miles away, right? It has to get close for that to be effective, almost like the effectivity of the Unkin response, like you discussed with us earlier, right? It's kind of like, you know, you have to be close to be able to appreciate the impact of it, right?
Yeah, well, it seems to depend on the species. So some work that's been done on Dendrobates tinctorius seems to indicate that it works exactly like that. But it's easy to see how something like the golden dart frog, the Phyllobates, would stick out from, you know, even a very great distance away. So it depends on the species and the context, and it may well depend on how toxic they are as well. So if you're extremely toxic, you can afford to be conspicuous from a great distance, whereas if you're less toxic, then it may be more advantageous to only appear conspicuous once you're really close. And then at the extreme end of that is these hidden signals that we discussed earlier, where you only reveal the hidden signal once the predator has detected you through a behavioral display.
And what does the future hold for your research? Because, I read through the abstract, I read through the article I found. What's the next step here for you in terms of like where you want your research to go?
Well, so specifically with respect to the evolution of aposematism, one thing that we're very interested in is how general this mechanism of hidden signals functioning as an intermediary between camouflage and aposematism is in other taxonomic groups. So right now what we're working on is we're testing the same hypothesis in elapid snakes to see if species that reveal a conspicuous signal only through behavioral means function to facilitate aposematism in the same way.
That's going to be interesting to see. It's funny that you bring up elapids. Some of them are so, like the ones in Australia, I think mm-hmm. it's like, I think it's the fear snake.
And yeah, the inland taipan.
Yeah. There's a few different species, and they're so incredibly toxic, yet they just look like these dull brown snakes. It's so unusual as compared to like a coral snake, which is so brightly colored.
Yeah, well, what I suspect is happening there is that the fear snake is highly venomous, but also they're predators of mammals mostly that if they were aposematic, they would stand out to their prey as well and have a disadvantage in terms of their hunting success. So it may be that predation sort of constrains the evolution of aposematism, whereas coral snakes, which are highly conspicuous, tend to feed on a lot of blind snakes and other reptiles that may be less susceptible to notice a brightly colored animal because they perceive the world through other modalities such as olfaction and touch and things like that. So it will be very interesting to do that research and sort of see what the macroevolutionary patterns are and how they differ between amphibians and snakes.
Yeah, there's so many complexities to it because I discuss this with people and they'll ask me, well, they'll look at a picture of frog and say, oh, that must be poisonous. And I say, no, not necessarily. And then, well, why? Well, it's brightly colored. It's like, well, not every brightly colored frog is toxic and not every toxic frog is brightly colored. It's just like, there's so much to it. And the more I discuss this type of topic with people, the more I realize how much goes into the evolution of any given species, even down to a locale, and how that mode of the evolution of man, where we started out as a lungfish and ended up holding a spear in our hands, it's so oversimplifies it, because there's just, it's like what's that game where you roll like a die that's got like 20 faces mm-hmm. on it. I think it's like Dungeons and Dragons, but like you roll the die and it's got 20 different faces on it. It's not just, heads or tails. It's got so many other possibilities and so many other directions in which everything can go, dependent on so many other factors. That just fascinates me.
Yeah, it's certainly highly nuanced. And it seems like the more research we do, the more nuanced it becomes and the more facets there are to all of these things. And because of that, I think there's room for an enormous amount of research to be done for generations to come.
Yeah. You could do boundless research with any given species regarding, evolution of coloration and chemical defenses. It's there's so many questions out there. And I'm always happy when I get to the end of an episode and I have a list of like 50 to 100 more questions. But it's such an interesting topic.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I hope to continue doing this research for many, many years to come.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've definitely enlightened me. I found this fascinating because that was that paradox that I always wondered about, and I'm glad I was able to discuss it with you.
Yeah, great, and thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Yeah. So, Carl, if any of the listeners want to be able to find more about your research, I mean, I'm gonna include some links in the show description. But if anybody wants to find out more, where would you direct them to go?
Yeah, so if you just Google my name in Google Scholar, you'll see my profile there. And unfortunately, a lot of the papers are behind a paywall. But if you would like access to any of my papers, just send me an email. And my email is there in my Google Scholar. And I'll be happy to send access to anyone who's interested.
Yeah, that's great. And you're right. It is tough sometimes when you want to get a paper. And you're right, you've got that paywall there. But yeah, I think that's great if you're able to share it with anybody who's interested in reading the full article.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one thing that's worth knowing is that you should be able to get the author's email address through almost any paper, and pretty much all researchers would be thrilled to share their research and send you a PDF if you send them an email. So anyone who's seen scientific articles that they'd like access to, that's probably the most expedient way to get them.
Yeah, it's a good way to get guests on the show. That's what I do. I'll be honest with you. I read a lot of papers. I read a lot of abstracts, and it's a great point of contact to reach out to somebody is when they include that email address in that abstract or that little brief article. All right. Well, everyone, I want to thank Carl so much for taking the time to come and talk to us about this. I mean, again, I love this topic, especially with dendrobatids, the relationship between coloration and toxicity and the evolution of where this all came from, how it ended up where it is and where it's going has always interested me. And I hope it interested you guys, too. So all in all, again, I want to thank Carl for taking the time coming to talk to us. I want to thank all of you for listening, and I will catch up with you guys again next time.